difficult to live with. They don't want a quiet life. You'll be left gasping in her wake. Rory absorbed this pronouncement. There was something thrilling about the concept of gasping in someone's wake. It sounded better than being set in aspic, or pickled in grief, at least. What was Mum like when you met her? Colin replaced his glasses, picked up his glass of wine, and smiled. Incredible, he said. Joyful. Glamorous. She looked like a model, hair down to her waist, always smiling. Hundreds of friends, always dancing, turning somersaults, doing cartwheels, hair everywhere, laughing, vibrant. It was like going out with summer. Rory had stopped breathing. His father's face was candescent. He'd never seen him look like that before. And then, Colin continued, well, you know, babies, more babies. Takes the edge off a bit. She thinks she's still happy, you know? I know. Even though Reese's dead. His father sighed. I know. What are we going to do about it? Colin looked at him curiously. I have no idea. How the hell do you help someone who insists on believing that she's happy? He blew out his cheeks and sighed again. To be honest, to be totally and entirely honest, he paused, then looked Rory directly in the eye. I've kind of given up. He glanced away then, quickly, but not too fast for Rory to see the look of guilt and regret that passed across his face. Colin drove them both to the airport 2 months later. Lorelei had said she was far too busy to come. Rory hadn't even wanted to know why. She'd hugged him hard the last time he'd seen her, and told him to have an incredible time, that she loved him, that she'd miss him, that she couldn't wait to hear all about his adventures. It had been a perfectly reasonable enactment of a mother and son farewell scenario. Any casual onlooker would have sighed and found it charming. But Rory had felt the distance in her body language, the need to be getting on with something else, to be elsewhere, otherwise occupied. Hurry up, said her body language. Hurry up and go. Kaylee and Colin were sitting in the front of the car, chatting about Andalusia. Kaylee flicking through her rough guide, pointing things out to him. Her hair was short now and white blonde. She looked like a beautiful little boy. From behind, it occurred to him in an uncomfortable wave of realization. She looked like Reese. He turned his gaze to the window and watched the countryside pass him by. It was high summer. The world was vivid green, with wide stripes of yellow where the rape fields grew. Everything was so familiar to him. The soft butterscotch of the Gloucestershire bricks, the evocative names of the villages, the peaty smell of the air, the solid feel of British tarmac beneath the tyres of his father's car. It was all he'd ever known. Oh, by the way, his father turned to address him, don't forget to call on your mother's birthday, will you? And Beth's, too, if you can remember. Oh, God, yeah, when is that? July the 19th. She'll be 23. Poor Beth, Rory sighed under his breath. What's that? Said Kaylee, picking up on the tiny, rising bubble of family discord. Oh, nothing, he said. Just feel sorry for her. Stuck at home on her own for her birthday. Seems a bit of a pitiful way to turn 23, that's all. I'm going to be 23 next year, said Kaylee, and I've been living away from home since I was 16. She needs to cut the apron strings. You know what I mean? And remember to give us a phone number, so we can let you know when Meg's baby comes. I'm pretty sure there won't be a phone there, said Kaylee. I kind of think that's supposed to be the idea. You know, a retreat. They were going to stay with a guy called Ken, to whom Kaylee had lost her virginity when she was 17 and he was 49. She'd met him at a festival in Limerick and stayed in touch with him. She referred to him, rather charmingly, as her pen pal. He now lived in a kind of informal commune in Andalusia with three girlfriends, some goats, some donkeys, and half a dozen children. He sounded both hideous and mesmerizing in equal measure. But he was giving them free board and lodgings in return for some light farming, building, decorating, and childcare, and given that Rory had exactly £200 to last him the month, it was an offer he couldn't reasonably refuse. "Are you still in love with him?" he'd asked. Kaylee had thrown him a withering look and said, "Are you mad, Rory Bird? You think I would take you across the world with me to stay with a man I'm in love with? What kind of a person do you think I am?" "I may be a lot of things, but a polygamist is not one of them." Which was kind of reassuring to hear. "Well then," said Colin, "be sure to get to a phone if you can around about the due date. Meg will be livid if you don't get in touch somehow." "Leave it with me, Colin," said Kaylee, gently touching his arm. "I'll make sure your son does all the right things. I promise you that." Colin turned and smiled at her and said, "Good girl." Rory still saw ghostly little Reese's everywhere. He could barely remember Reese as a teenager, but he vividly remembered him at 9, freewheeling down this hill on his BMX. He remembered Reese at 6, trying to keep up with him as they chased through those woods together, looking for the wild pigs that someone at school had said they'd seen there. He saw Reese sitting on the steps with him outside the chemist on the high street, with his chin on his hands, waiting for Mum and the girls to come out with bags of things that were of no interest to either of them. And he remembered Reese sitting there, in the boot of the hatchback where he always wanted to sit, facing backwards, his legs stretched out and the dog in his lap. And now Rory was going somewhere that Reese had never been. He wondered if the ghosts would follow him there. And if they didn't, he wondered if he would miss them. Chapter 4. April 2011. Reese's room was just as it always had been. The sheer volume of empty space before her almost took Meg's breath away. "My God," she muttered. She kept it. She kept it as it was. "That's freaky," said Molly. "Totally." "It really is. I mean, how could she have controlled her impulses? It's like, I don't know, if she could stop herself hoarding in this room, why couldn't she stop herself doing it in the others? If she could control part of herself, then why not the rest?" The ancient floorboards creaked and complained beneath their feet. Reese's bed sat stripped bare in the far corner. His wardrobe was empty. His desk piled with just a few objects. An encyclopedia, a pot of pens, some folders, deodorant in a rusting 90s-designed aerosol can. There was his stereo, a huge thing, designed for CDs and records that had never heard of MP3s or iTunes. And posters on the wall. Dozens of them. Pearl Jam, Nirvana, NWA, Alice in Chains, Courtney Love. "It's like a museum of the 90s, said Molly. Meg nodded and smiled. It was. Untouched. Just clothes and bedding taken out. Everything else as it had been that day, when she'd put down that tray of food and kicked down the door. She ran her hand around the inside of the door and felt it there, the lock still hanging off the door by uprooted nails.
"And is that where he, you know, did it?"
Molly nodded toward the buttress beams in the high ceiling. "Yeah," said Meg.
"With rope?"
"Yes. A very long piece of rope."
"Where'd he get it?"
"What?" The rope?
Where did he get a very long piece of rope?
Christ, I don't know.
What, like the village rope shop or something?
Meg threw her daughter a look of only half-formed outrage.
And how did he get it up there?
She nodded again at the beams. It was there, said Meg, the image coming to her clear as the present moment. She pointed to a lower section of the beam. He stood on a chair. That chair. Molly paced across the room, her arms outstretched. She put a hand on the chair and said,
Same age as me.
Nearly. She let her hand fall from the chair and turned to her mother.
Isn't that crazy? He was the same age as me. I mean, what was he like? Would I have liked him?
Meg smiled sadly. No, she said. You wouldn't have liked him. You would have called him sad and a loser, and you'd have stood and stared at him pityingly every time he walked past you at school, assuming you'd even noticed his existence in the first place, that is. Molly looked affronted for a moment, and then her face softened.
That's really tragic.
I know. He was really tragic. It was. I remember when Alfie started secondary school. God, I was terrified for him.
What about me?
You? Well, I knew you'd be fine. Alpha female that you are. That you have always been. But Alfie reminds me sometimes of Rhys. So quiet, you know. So few friends. And that was when it all went wrong for Rhys. The day he started at the big school. That was the beginning of the end.
But Alfie was fine.
Yes. Alfie was fine. Meg smiled. Is fine.
Best boy out there. Molly blushed.
Meg gazed at her in surprise. Really? You think that?
Well, yeah. Alfie rocks. He's brilliant.
Meg's stomach rolled pleasantly. Good, she said. I like that very much. She absorbed the wonder of Molly's pronouncement, took it as a compliment on her parenting, on her mothering, as a certificate of excellence. But then she felt her pride fade away at the thought that if Rhys had had a big sister like Molly, maybe he would have thought that he was worth more than 16 years of life. Her phone rang again and she sighed. It was unknown again. It might be her. But then again, it might be any number of people who needed to talk to her in the wake of the death of the county's worst hoarder. She inhaled. Hello?
Meg, please, it's me. Please don't hang up.
Meg waited just one beat, listened to the sound of her sister's urgent, panicked breath down the line, and then she ended the call. March 1997. Beth collapsed into the sofa and caught her breath.
You're a natural, said Meg, scooping wooden blocks back into a drawstring bag.
I'm absolutely not, she replied. I have no idea how you do it, and in your condition.
She pointed at the enormous bump straining the fabric of Meg's T-shirt.
Well, said Meg, pulling herself with some effort to a standing position and throwing the bag of bricks into a plastic crate. It's not as if I have a lot of choice.
Sit down, for God's sake, urged Beth, patting the cushion next to her.
Not quite yet, I'm afraid. I've got a wash to hang out and a shirt to iron, and then I can sit down.
Here.
She threw Beth the remote control.
Enjoy.
Beth watched Meg leave the room. From behind, you could not see her bump. She was all out the front. But it was obvious from the duck-like roll of her gait that she was heavily, urgently pregnant. Her second baby had been due 4 days ago. Beth had come down to help out with Molly while Meg was having the baby. But the baby was still not here. And now Beth was rather concerned that she was not going to make it home for Easter.
Rory and Kaylee were still living in Spain. Their one-month holiday had extended itself into several months, and they'd been living on a hippie commune with this guy called Ken for nearly 2 years now. Having made it home for Easter last year with baby Molly in tow, Meg and Bill were once more out of commission due to reasons of imminent confinement, and Dad was going to be away on business. Again. So it all came down to Beth. She'd promised her mum that she'd be there, and she had no intention of letting her down. Good old Beth. She heard the key turn in the lock and stiffened slightly. She touched her hair and cleared her throat. Then she rearranged her legs, crossed them, and then uncrossed them again. "Hi," she said as Bill walked into the room. All thick, shaggy hair, trendy trainers, and soft, smiling, careworn face. "Hi there, Beth," he said, dropping a flight bag onto the dining table and flicking through a pile of letters. "Where's Meg?"
"She's hanging up washing and ironing a shirt."
Bill grimaced. "She's a lunatic," he said.
"What the fuck is she doing ironing shirts in her condition?"
"You know Meg. Never could sit still."
"Well, yes," he said absent-mindedly, sliding his finger under the flap of an envelope. "But sometimes you really do just have to."
He looked up and glanced around.
"Molly gone to bed?"
Beth nodded.
"Oh," he sounded disappointed. "Must be later than I thought.
Might just go in and have a look at her."
"No, you won't," they heard Meg call through from the kitchen. "You'll wake her up."
He smiled indulgently.
"No," he called back. "I won't wake her up, darling, I promise you."
"Well," Meg called back, "if you wake her up, then you have to get her back to sleep."
"Deal," said Bill, throwing Beth a conspiratorial smile that turned her stomach to milk. Then he put down the letters and headed back into the hallway. Beth let herself relax. It was terrible. Truly, truly terrible. This crush on Meg's partner. It had come from nowhere. From out of the blue. For 2 years he had just been Bill. Just this nice bloke who lived with her sister. Just this amiable, fluffy-haired guy with an easy smile and twinkling eyes. She was sure the change had come from him. She was sure he'd started it. She hadn't even packed any pretty clothes to come down to stay. If she'd already suspected she had feelings, however subliminal, for him, she'd have packed something nice to wear. Pretty pajamas, that kind of thing. But she hadn't. So clearly this, whatever this was, had not been started by her. No. It was him. It was the way he looked at her. This complicity that had developed between the two of them. He and Beth against Meg. Sort of. Vaguely. I mean, it was clear to Beth, blindingly clear, that Bill adored Meg. He adored Meg and he adored Molly and he adored his flat and his family and his life. But still, there was something there when he looked at her. Something that had definitely not been there before. And, Beth was pretty certain, that thing was sex. Meg went into labour very early the following morning. Meg and Bill left Beth at home with a still-sleeping Molly and instructions for how to get her to her childminder at 9 a.m. It was the first time Beth had been alone in their flat. She sat at the breakfast bar in her ugly pyjamas and sipped at a cup of tea and stared at the clock on the kitchen wall as it ticked over from 6:32 to 6:33. It was so quiet. She thought about phoning home to let her mother know what was going on. But then she envisaged her mother's slightly panicky journey from deepest sleep to the phone that sat on the landing, and she knew, anyway, that her mother would only have the most passing interest in something that might not, in theory, happen for another 2 or more days, and would probably be a bit cross about being woken up. So she decided to wait until 9 o'clock, or until there was some news, whichever came first. In the meantime, she stared around at the silent kitchen,
taking in the details she hadn't picked up on before, when the place was full of Meg and Bill and Molly and all their loud distractions. It was built into the corner of a large living room from shiny white units with brushed steel handles. There was not a fingerprint or a splash of dirt on anything. A small collage of neatly arranged family photographs hung on the wall in a white frame. A glass vase of yellow gerbera daisies sat on the immaculate windowsill. Knives, forks and spoons all sat in soldier-like rows in the cutlery drawer. And there were exactly 8 white plates, 8 white bowls, 8 white side plates, 8 white egg cups and 1 salt and pepper cellar. Even in a state of labour, Megan had left the house pristine. Fluffed cushions, tidied toys, remote controls neatly arranged in a row on the clutter-free coffee table, clean shoes set in straight pairs in the hallway, a wash hung to dry on a plastic dryer, coats hung in size order from pegs on the wall, not a speck of dust anywhere, not even on picture rails, not even on light bulbs. Like a show home. Lorelei would hate it. Beth sighed, and carefully, almost reverently, placed her teacup in the showroom shiny dishwasher. Then she tiptoed to the door of Molly's little room and peered in. It was as immaculate as the rest of Meg's flat. The only thing in the room that lacked order was Molly herself, buried within her little duvet which she had gathered around herself in twisted clumps. Her reddish-brown hair was tangled over her face and across her mouth, and one of her plump arms was dangled through the bars of her cot, her fat fingers trailing against the unstained cream carpet. Beth felt overwhelmed for a moment with love for her niece, and her insistence on subverting the lines of Meg's strictly ordered world. Good girl, she thought. Good girl. Not that Beth blamed Meg in the slightest for being the way she was. How could she be otherwise, given how much she'd always railed against her mother's ways? But a little bit of give. A little bit of flexibility wouldn't have gone amiss. She saw it in Bill's glances sometimes. Little twitches of his eyebrows. Little half-formed smiles or grimaces. Bill hadn't signed up for this. He hadn't signed up for not being able to kick off his trainers and drop the remote control absent-mindedly down the side of the sofa. He hadn't signed up for there being a right way and a wrong way to hang up a tea towel or open a carton of orange juice. He hadn't signed up for tiny, aggressive, handheld vacuum cleaners that sucked away crumbs before he'd even noticed them, and newspapers being folded away and disposed of before he'd even read them, and half-eaten packets of biscuits being thrown away because a new packet had been purchased. He really, really hadn't. But he was a good sport. He didn't like it, but he put up with it. Because Meg was Meg, and he loved her. She tiptoed away from Molly's room and then peered into the tiny little box room that had once been an office, and now housed a shelving unit full of carefully arranged baby accoutrements. A pile of tiny nappies, already out of their packets and stacked just so. A pile of ice-white muslin squares and nipple pads and baby grows, and soft animals and jars of cream and fluffy towels. They didn't know what they were having. A strangely laissez-faire attitude, mainly down to Bill, who would clearly appreciate a few more surprises in his life. Everyone thought it would be a boy, just because everyone always thought it would be a boy. But Beth thought it would be another girl. She could see it in the extra bloom on Meg's skin. The clock ticked round to 6:37. Beth decided to take a very quick shower. The only shower in the flat was in the ensuite to Meg and Bill's room, so she hadn't used it before. She took the soft blue towel that had been left folded just so for her at the foot of the little put-you-up bed in the box room, and she checked once more on Molly, and then she walked through Meg and Bill's bedroom. Bed made, slippers in pairs, coordinated cushions, and into their shower room. She showered fast, mainly because she didn't want Molly to wake up and find herself alone, but also because she felt she shouldn't be in here, in their little sanctuary, in the place where Bill and Megan took their clothes off, in the place where they brushed their teeth together every night and had private conversations and made plans for their future. She didn't use any of their products for fear of messing anything up, and after her shower, she sprayed the inside of the cubicle with the spray that had been left for that purpose, and she cleared all the glass walls with the window scraper, and then she wrapped her blue towel about herself and dashed back to the little box room, where she dressed and put on a tiny bit of makeup. It was now almost 7 a.m. She wondered if they were at the hospital yet. She wondered what they were doing. She wondered how this day was going to pan out. She wondered how the next few days would pan out. The baby would be in a Moses basket in their room at first, and Meg had said she could stay in the box room as long as she liked. In fact, she'd said, "Please stay, please, I need you." But there was Easter to think about, and Mum. There was also the lack of space in this tiny flat, and the stress of living with a newborn. And more than any of that, there was this thing between herself and Bill. If the baby came home tomorrow, she could stay another 24 hours and then still be home in time for Easter lunch. Beth knew, on a fundamental level, that her sister needed her more than her mother did. She knew that Easter lunch was not as important, in the scheme of things, as spending time with her new niece or nephew. But the sheer, ground-in pull of it, of her mother's emotional neediness, was virtually impossible for her to ignore.
"Mama,"
said a small voice in the hall outside her room.
"Mama?"
"Hello, sweetie." She quickly got to her feet and went to Molly.
"Where, Mama?"
She looked dishevelled, almost Neanderthal. Her hair was a puffball of knotted curls, and her cheeks were blotchy with sleep. "How did you get out of your cot, sweetie?"
"Mama?"
"Mama's gone to have the baby. To the hospital. With Daddy."
"Mama have a baby?"
she asked thoughtfully. "Yes, at the hospital."
"Beth make toast?"
"Yes." Beth breathed a sigh of relief that the news had not been met with tears or anxiety. "Beth make a toast. Come on, sweetie." She took her niece's small hand in hers and led her to the kitchen, where she sat her in her high chair. Molly looked just like Meg, just like her, just like Dad and Auntie Lorna. She had the bird face. It still took Beth by surprise that this child existed. It felt like only a few minutes ago that they had all been children themselves. And, in fact, in most respects, Beth still was. She still lived at home. She still slept in a single bed. She still used the same face flannel and stared at the same face in the same mirror in the same bathroom. She still had breakfast with her mum and dad every morning, and drove her dad's car and ate food bought and prepared by her parents. She was, to all intents and purposes, 17 years old. Except she wasn't. She was 24. A 24-year-old woman. In July, she would be 25. She had no idea why she was still at home. She had a boyfriend. They'd been together for 4 years. His name was Simon, and he was doing a master's in combined science in York. She only saw him every fortnight or so, and even then he was too distracted and stressed even to contemplate having conversations about their future. Not that she wanted to have conversations about their future. She didn't know what she wanted yet. She didn't have a clue. She'd done a secretarial course just under 6 years ago. She could type a letter in a minute and a half, and take down a garbled conversation in shorthand, and program a word processor to print addresses onto envelopes. She was working for a local building company as PA to the managing director. Her boss said she was the best secretary he'd ever had, and given her 3 pay rises already. She was great-looking. Other people told her that all the time. Complete strangers, sometimes. She was young, she was hard-working and bright and conscientious, and yet... She gazed again upon her niece, chasing a slippery piece of banana around the tray of her high chair with one chubby finger. The child that her sister and her partner had made together. That her sister had grown in her body, in her womb, had pushed out and fed and nurtured and got to the age of nearly two without any harm coming to her, whilst simultaneously washing lots of clothes and plumping lots of cushions and buying lots of fresh fruit and working part-time in the school and making a whole other baby. She just couldn't imagine any of it. How did a human make all those decisions? All the big ones and all the little ones. How would you know you were doing it right? How could you trust yourself? Beth did not trust herself in the slightest. She felt much safer bobbing about in the same patterns and the same places with the same people. She thought back to the year Rhys had died. She remembered sitting in a weird wine bar near Covent Garden with Megan before Meg had met Bill, when she was 18 and Meg was 20, and they were both still vaguely on a par with each other. And she remembered Meg suggesting that she could come and live in London with her, come and share her bedroom. She'd been half tempted. It had seemed a soft entry into the world of grown-upness. Her sister there by her side to hold her hand. But then Rhys had done what Rhys had done. And how could she? How could she have left them all there? And so she had stayed. And stayed. And stayed. And the only mistake she was currently in danger of making, she realised, was the mistake of leaving it all far too late. Meg was at a hospital called the Whittington in Highgate. It was big and Victorian and scary-looking, and it was hard to believe that something as wholesome and cheerful as the arrival of newborn babies was happening within its mouldering walls. Beth was directed to a labouring room, which put her in mind of a room full of men in dungarees with pitchforks and chisels and sweaty backs, where she found Meg and Bill flicking through magazines and eating tortilla chips. "Was she all right?" asked Meg the minute Beth walked into the room. "Absolutely fine. Honestly. She is one cool customer. She didn't even say goodbye." "Oh, thank God," said Meg, holding her hand against her chest. "That's the first time anyone apart from me or Bill has ever dropped her off. I thought she might freak out a bit." "No, she's been a little angel. Ate all her breakfast, let me change her nappy. Wasn't too keen on getting into her pram, but we managed it in the end." Beth beamed. She was feeling strangely powerful. She had not only cared for her niece single-handedly, she had also successfully navigated the streets of a frankly rather terrifying inner London neighbourhood with a child in a pram, and then found her way, using public transport, to the hospital. "How are you?" she asked, her eyes directed at Meg's stomach. "Well, apparently I'm only 5 centimetres dilated and my contractions have slowed right down, so it looks like we might be here for the long haul." "The childminder lady, Danielle?" "Yes, that one. She said Molly can stay extra hours. She said she can keep her until 6, if you like." Meg smiled. "Oh," she said happily, "that's great. I love that woman. Have you told Mum?" Beth gasped. "Oh, God," she said. "I'm really sorry. I completely forgot. I was going to do it earlier, but I didn't want to wake her. And then Molly woke up and it was all so busy, just getting her ready and everything." And Meg rolled her eyes and sighed. "My family is unbelievable," she said. "Completely." "There's payphones round the corner. I'll go and call her now." Bill counted some coins out of the pocket of his jeans and gave Beth a complicitous smile that made her catch her breath. But there was no reply at home, and Beth went back to Meg's room. "You know," said Meg, "in other families, in normal families, the mother would have been here right now, holding my hand, helping out. And please, God, don't think I'm not grateful to you, because I really, really am. But you shouldn't have to be doing this. You have your own life to live. My mother should be here. And if she can't be here,
She should be on the phone every hour asking for news. You know, she has not called me once since my due date. Not once since... Ah, Jesus! Ah! She clutched the sides of the bed and sat up rigidly, her teeth clenched together and her eyes screwed shut. Bill jumped to his feet and took her hand. Another one? He asked. Oh! Replied Meg. Jesus Christ! Beth stared at her older sister through wide circles of eyes. She'd never seen another human being make that face before, or the noise that came with it. It was horrible. Shall I call the nurse? She asked, edging towards the door. Meg relaxed the rictus mask of her face and said, No, don't be daft. It's just a contraction. I'll be fine. A contraction, thought Beth. What is a contraction? It was a word that meant nothing to her beyond a vague association with the mechanics of childbirth. What does it feel like? She asked. It feels, began Meg, like a gigantic metal fist, squeezing and twisting and pulling all your internal organs until you think you're about to pass out. It is the most revolting feeling imaginable, and, you know, as much as I think our mother is completely and utterly useless in almost every respect, I will always have the greatest admiration for the fact that when she had the twins, she had to do this twice. In the same day. Beth smiled. Meg had said the same thing last time, after Molly was born, and had been terrified during both pregnancies that the sonographer was going to point out two babies on the screen. Coming up for 6 years, she said, her thoughts turning to Reese. I can't quite believe it. Meg nodded. 22, she sighed. I wonder what he'd be doing now.
Reese?
Asked Bill, looking over the top of his magazine. They nodded.
Poor soul, he said.
Has Mum been to his grave lately? Asked Meg. Beth bit her lip and shook her head. You? She shrugged. She kept meaning to. Not really.
Not really? I mean, you either have or you haven't.
Well, in which case, no, I haven't.
Oh, God, Beth.
I know, she interjected defensively. It's just... It's so scary there. I don't like going on my own. I always feel like I'm going to get raped or something.
Can't you go with Dad?
I suppose. It's just... He's hardly ever around. And when he is, he's just kind of... busy.
Busy doing what?
Oh, God, I don't know. Just doing stuff. Writing his memoirs, apparently, though I've never seen anything he's written. And catching up on correspondence. Anything to keep him away from Mum and Vicky. She sighed. She hated talking about home. It made it sound all wrong. Whereas when she was there, living there, just getting on with her life, it all felt perfectly reasonable. But Beth was spared the trouble of taking this conversation to its uncomfortable extrapolation by the onset of another contraction, the sight of her big sister throwing herself back against the pillows and screaming, Jesus fucking Christ in bollocks, let me die! Meg was still having irregular contractions by the time Beth had to leave the hospital to collect Molly from the childminder. There was talk of doing something to get them coming more frequently, to move labour along, but it seemed to Beth that the baby was not coming any time soon, and that she would be required to stay overnight with Molly and repeat all of today's processes over again tomorrow, which was fine. She had finally got through to Lorelei at about midday, who had said, Oh, how marvellous! Tell her I'll be keeping my fingers crossed for her all day. And Vicky will too, won't you, Vee? She'd heard Vicky chirrup something affirmative in the background and made a mental note not to share Vicky's best wishes with her sister. Well, I'd better be off, darling, her mother had said a moment later. Time to collect Sophie from nursery. And then we're taking her to get new shoes. Let me know the minute there's any news, though, won't you, darling? And big hugs to Meggie and Bill. It had been as if she'd called to tell her that Meg's car was in for an MOT, or that her cat was having an operation.
but she dismissed the thought before it grew roots. It was just her mother's way. Lorelei filled her head with the things closest to her, the here and now, not the over there and then. It was how she was. It didn't mean she was a bad person. But still, Beth had waited a count of 5 or so minutes before returning to Meg's bedside, where she'd slapped a joyful smile on her face and said nothing about new shoes for Sophie. She took Molly to a playground on the way home. An old lady admired the little girl and said, "She looks just like you." And Beth smiled and said, "She's not mine, actually. She's my niece. I'm just looking after her while my sister's in hospital having the second baby." The old lady smiled back and said, "You'll have your own one day, then." And Beth's smile stretched out uncomfortably, and she said, "Yes, I'm sure I will. Yes. I'm one of 4, so, you know."
"Yes, when you come from a big family, you want it for yourself, don't you? But you shouldn't wait too long. Not if you want your children to be close to their cousins."
She said this sternly, with a hint of insight, as if she knew. As if she'd looked at Beth and seen inside her soul. Seen a clear line to her future. But then her smile softened and she said,
"But you're still young. No rush, really, is there, dear?"
Beth laughed nervously, politely.
"No," she said. "No rush at all."
But she knew that there was. And it had nothing to do with babies. Before she could even begin to think about babies, she first had to find her way to the starting blocks of life. She was reading Bridget Jones's diary. She found it on her sister's alphabetically ordered bookshelves. It had been published the year before, and everyone had been talking about it and telling her she should read it. But Beth didn't really read. Usually she watched TV with her mum until she was so tired she could barely speak, and then she flopped into bed. But Molly was finally asleep in her cot after a long and rather disordered evening, and there was no one to watch TV with, hence the book. It was quite funny, although she found it hard to relate to all the talk of weight gain. She never gained weight. And drinking. She never drank. And mad, mouthy girlfriends. She had no mad, mouthy girlfriends. But she was enjoying the bits about the heroine's crush on an unsuitable older man. Although, no, she would not call what she was experiencing a crush. No, it was not a crush, it was a frisson. Just a sort of electrical thing, invisible to the naked eye, like a tripwire. It was in the way he looked at her when there was no reason to be looking at her. The way he grasped her by the waist when he hugged her hello and goodbye. And she still hadn't decided whether she was flattered or appalled. She was going to turn down the corner of the page, and then realised that bent corners were probably on Meg's long list of minor domestic misdemeanours, so she inserted a hair clip instead, and was about to turn off the bedside lamp when she heard a sound that made her heart beat violently. It was the front door. She heard it first open, and then click shut. Very gently. She held her breath and put a hand over her racing heart. She envisaged gangsters. She envisaged knives and guns. She envisaged being gang-raped and brutally murdered. She envisaged all the things that she never worried about when she was at home in the Cotswolds. She did not belong here, in the city. It was not the place for her. She wanted to go home. Home to the country. Her safe, cosy room in her parents' safe, cosy house. Why did Meg live here? Why had she had children here, in this terrible place? She glanced around the room, looking for something heavy or sharp, or both. But all she could see was nappies and plush bears. She gulped back a strangled cry and was about to start whimpering when she heard a man clear his throat outside her bedroom door. Bill. She breathed out and smiled. She opened her door and peered out into the hallway. Bill was unzipping his jacket. He turned at the sound of her, and his face softened, and he said, "Hi, sorry. Did I wake you?" She said, "No, not at all. I was awake. I thought you were burglars."
"Burglars? Plural?"
"Yes, a whole gang of them." He smiled.
"Sorry. I'm clearly not as light-footed as I thought I was."
"So?" she said. "Any news?"
"Well, if you call a 9-pound, 9-ounce baby boy with bright red hair news, then yes, we have news."
Beth squealed and then covered her mouth with her hands. Then, unable to find a less noisy alternative, she skipped across the hallway and threw herself into Bill's embrace. "Oh, wow!" she whispered loudly into his ear. "Wow, congratulations! A boy! Amazing!" He didn't caress her waist this time. He didn't hold on to her for that split second longer than necessary. There was nothing within their embrace beyond mutual delight. He had, of course, just watched his beloved wife push an enormous baby out of herself. "Come and have a drink with me," he said, glancing towards the living room. She nodded and smiled and followed him through. She sat cross-legged on the sofa while Bill found something in the fridge for them to drink.
"Is she okay? Are they both okay?"
He smiled and said, "They are both absolutely fine. Once the contraction started to regulate, it all happened really quickly. Bam, 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 virtually popped out like a champagne cork. Talking of which..."
He waved a green bottle at her. "This has been sitting in the fridge, waiting for a special occasion since Molly was born. What do you think?" Her instinct was to say no. She was virtually teetotal. It would go straight to her head, and then she'd have to go to bed, and it would be completely wasted on her. But on the other hand, a boy, safely delivered. It would be churlish not to.
"I think that's a lovely idea. Just a glass, though. Maybe we can save the rest for Meg tomorrow."
"Good thinking," said Bill. "I should probably take it easy, too. Big day tomorrow."
"When is she allowed home?"
"First thing, I reckon. We were waiting for the paediatrician, but she never came. So I decided I'd come back and get some decent kip before the onslaught begins." "Again," he smiled wryly.
"Easy a second time round, though.
You know what you're doing."
He raised an eyebrow at her sardonically.
"You reckon?"
He brought the bottle and two glasses over and sat down next to her on the sofa.
"I called your mum, told her the news."
"Oh," said Beth. "Good.
Was she suitably thrilled?"
He shrugged. "She was reasonably delighted, I suppose. She said something about some 3 packs of baby grows she'd seen last week and how she'd bought them in pink and in blue just in case and how she'll hold on to the pink ones just in case and maybe get some more and blah, blah, blah. Though she did perk up a bit when I told her what we were calling him."
"So, what's my nephew going to be called?"
"Alfie," replied Bill.
"Or Alfred Reese Liddington Bird, if we're being more formal."
"Oh," said Beth softly. "That's lovely. Mum must have been thrilled. And Dad?" "Alfred Reese." She tasted the name on her tongue. For a moment, she felt envious that Meg had got in there first. Had the baby boy to replace the one they'd lost. Got to give him that name. Got to make everyone smile and feel better for a moment. She smiled sadly. "It's a gorgeous name," she said. "Really gorgeous. And where did the red hair come from?"
"Well," said Bill, putting his hand up, "that'll be my lot. I'm the only one without red hair in my family. Seriously, when I was growing up, I felt like the Steve Martin character in that film, what's it called, where he's the only white kid in the family. The Jerk. Yeah. My mum's auburn, my dad's carrot, and my brothers are both flame red. So," he shrugged, "there was always a danger this might happen."
"I love red hair,"
said Beth.
I can't wait to see him.
He passed her a glass of champagne and picked up another one for himself.
To Alfie, he started, and to Megan, Beth finished.
Absolutely, he said, blowing out his cheeks in a suggestion of awe at Meg's recent exertions.
To remarkable Megan.
And to you, said Beth, for reasons she could not quite explain.
Ha! Not sure what I've done to deserve a toast.
Well, you know, it's what you did 9 months ago. He laughed out loud and raised his glass and said,
Oh, well, yes, of course. To my amazing ability to impregnate fertile women. Cheers.
Beth laughed too. She felt both embarrassed and delighted.
And to you. A big thank you for today. For taking care of Moll, holding the fort and keeping the place up to your sister's unfeasibly high standards.
Oh, God, don't, said Beth. It's been hell. Every time Molly touches something or moves something, I'm in a total state of terror in case I put it back in the wrong place or the wrong way up. I have to keep making mental notes of where things go. He laughed again.
Oh, yes, that all sounds very familiar. Although she'll probably cut you some slack, what with you being her sister and all.
I've definitely inherited more of Mum's approach to housekeeping.
Ah, said Bill. You're a bit of a hoarder too, are you?
Well, no, not in that way. I don't really buy much stuff, or collect things, like my mum does. But then again, I don't really throw stuff out, either. I don't organise stuff, it's all just in a jumble. Nothing matches. I mean, you can probably tell from the way I dress that I'm not really fussed about, well, you know, being just so.
I love the way you dress, said Bill, a little too fast.
Oh, said Beth. Thank you.
Yes, you always look very feminine.
Oh, she said again. I never really thought... I mean, I just kind of throw stuff together, really. Stuff I like. It's organic, he finished for her. I suppose. She found herself mentally picturing Megan then, in one of her impeccably put-together outfits, usually trousers to cover her heavy knees, black and grey and white and cream, slightly masculine tailoring for her job at the school, softer for at home, jeans and T-shirts that flattered her athletic top half, her small breasts and narrow waist. The T-shirts always looked brand new, mainly because she ironed them. Beth had joyfully shared this titbit with her mother when she'd returned from her first visit to Meg's flat just before Molly was born.
She irons T-shirts! And knickers! No, I'm not joking. She irons everything.
And her jeans were always sparkling indigo without a hint of a worn patch or frayed edge. Meg always looked shower fresh, salon fresh, boutique fresh. She always smelled of soap, because she was always washing her hands, and the expensive perfume she bought for herself from Space NK. Her fingernails were always snipped and scrubbed, her trainers always clean and fragrant. She was the kind of statuesque, immaculate, capable woman who, without even opening her mouth, managed to intimidate every other woman in her vicinity. Beth had been in her shadow all her life. She enjoyed being in her shadow. She'd never wanted the spotlight. It didn't suit her. Beth let Meg and her mother do all the loud, look-at-me grandstanding, while she and her dad quietly got on with things without making any fuss. It was the way it worked. It was fine. But Beth could feel a strange, subtle shift inside herself, like the imperceptible movement of tectonic plates, just a millimetre here and there. Just enough to open her mind to the possibility of more. More life. More love. More attention. She smiled at Bill.
I mean, she continued, slightly ingenuously, I just don't think about clothes too much. You know, it's not a priority for me. As long as it's relatively clean and it's not completely out of fashion, I don't really care where it came from and whether it whether it matches my T-shirt.
I know, said Bill, just as she'd known he would.
And that's something I really, really like about you. You're just so very... natural.
Bethan got back to the birdhouse at midday on Easter Sunday. She had 2 whole rolls of film in her bag that she would take to Boots on Tuesday to have developed, full of photos of Molly and Megan and Bill and gorgeous fat Alfie, with his thick shock of red hair and his air of vague surprise. Bill had brought Meg and Alfie home from the hospital the morning after she and Bill had drank champagne together. Meg had looked shell-shocked and jubilant with her huge new baby at her breast and her stomach a punctured barrage balloon beneath her striped lycra tunic top. Molly had been wide-eyed and horrified, but then lost interest very quickly and insisted on Beth taking her for a round of mini croquet in the back garden. And then they had settled down into a lovely unit of 4. 2 parents, 2 children. Everything fresh and new and exciting. Beth had quickly felt surplus to requirements and booked her train ticket home with a sense of relief. At Meg's insistence, Bill had taken her to the train station, and their conversation had been gentle and bland. Apart from a splinter of a moment just as she was getting out of the car when he'd said, "We'll miss you." She'd said, "No, you won't. You've got each other." And he'd said, "Well, yes, but it's always nice having you around." And it had been somewhere between avuncular and pensive, with a delicate lace of flirtation around the edges. She'd ignored it and gone, marched into the train station without looking backwards. But the thought of it had rested in her consciousness like a warm, seductive hand the whole way back to the village. Vicky was in the garden with the girls. She was blowing bubbles for them from a plastic bottle, and they were chasing them around with their arms in the air. She kept their hair short. Bethan had never found out why. They wore cords and stripy jumpers and blue Wellington boots, and looked like 2 small boys. Vicky herself was dressed in one of her stretchy dresses, in a bold tribal print that she bought from a catalogue that seemed to sell nothing but clothes in bold tribal prints for extroverted ladies who were a bit overweight and shouldn't really wear bold tribal prints but didn't care and wore them anyway. Her thick blonde hair was cut into a harsh jaw-length bob and was starting to look faded and grey in the brash midday sun. Her breasts were swinging from side to side as she ran girlishly around in circles with her bottle of bubbles. She beamed at the sight of Bethan and said, "Hurrah, you're home!" She greeted Beth with one of her pungently perfumed embraces and said, "Girls, girls, look who's here! Beth's home!" The girls waved shyly at Beth. Maddie showed her her stash of pastel-coloured chocolate eggs, and Beth noticed that she had a preponderance of pink. "Do you like pink, Maddie?" she asked. And Maddie nodded and said, "Pink is my favourite colour."
"Yes," said Sophie, "and pink is not my favourite colour. My favourite colour is blue."
"Oh, yes," said Beth, peering into Sophie's basket. "So it is." "Well, that works out very nicely then, doesn't it?" She smiled tightly and felt herself swimming through a sudden wave of sickening emotion. She remembered herself at Maddie's age, full of unquestioning love for her family, for the world around her, for pink eggs and pink raincoats and pink icing. She remembered how she had adored her big sister, envied her the curl in her hair and her strong physique and her authoritative position within the family, closer in age to Bethan, but almost on a par with her mother and father. She closed her eyes against the wave and found herself outside Reese's bedroom 6 years ago today. Easter Sunday. She saw her father trying to locate the volume button on Reese's stereo, pulling at his thin hair with his hands, saying, "How the fuck do you turn this thing off?" The first time Beth had ever heard her father use bad language. And then the silence, when he finally turned it off, and the unearthly creak of the rope swinging against the beams. Her mother standing on her tiptoes on a chair, frantically pulling at the knot in the rope with her long, sinewy fingers. Megan trying to help by pushing against his bare feet from below. She remembered her own fingers twisted around the doorframe, holding on to it to stop herself from falling.